Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this evening's June 2009 edition of Science News Update. I'm your host, Jim Campanella. Tonight, among other topics, we are going to look into an area of publishing that many of you, even professional writers among you, probably know very little about, and that is the world of scientific/academic publishing. And there is a rather disturbing story associated with my background this evening, so be patient for a while I ramble a bit. I have been publishing scientific research articles now for about 13 years. I have 25 articles where I'm senior communicating author. Translation, the guy who directed the laboratory work and actually wrote the paper. And another 10 or 15 book chapters on various review subjects. And please, I am not giving you these stats for any ego trip. I'm giving them to you so that you will know I have a bit of experience and know what I'm talking about. So how does academic publishing in journals differ from the world of quote-unquote real publishing? First, scientists normally do not get paid for their writing. The journals do not pay us dime one for what sometimes amounts to years of writing and research. In fact, some so-called open publishing journals, a translation, they give away their content for free, actually charge the author to be published because they do not charge for subscriptions. I have just finished the final revision of a 20-page manuscript for the journal Population Ecology. It took a year and a half of revisions to make the editors and reviewers happy. Between myself, who did the yeoman share of the work, and my co-authors, hundreds of hours of work were involved just in the writing process, and I neither expect nor will I get any remuneration for that work, except for my own satisfaction and possibly a promotion to full professor in a few years to come. A second difference is that we have peer review in our writing. This means that when a manuscript arrives at the publishers, it does not just go to the editors for a decision on publishing. It gets sent off to several other researchers who are highly published experts in the field, from 2 to 3 depending on the journal. These peer reviewers are so petty, they will deconstruct your scientific paper down to its individual letters. They review for content, scientific worth, originality, methodology, whether you reached your goals or not, results, and of course the quality of the writing itself. Depending on the eminence of the journal, some of those qualifications may outweigh others. For example, a few years ago, I sent a manuscript to the major journal, Nature. Now, Nature is among 2 or 3 or maybe 4 journals in the world that are the oldest and most respected and prestigious. And most journals, you send something in and it usually takes at least a month for them to get back to you with a decision. Nature returned with a decision, and yes, negative, as you could have guessed, in a matter of 24 hours. They rejected the paper because the work was, quote, not novel enough, unquote. They had not even sent it to the reviewers yet. It was just the policy that if a manuscript was just not interesting enough, it got rejected out of hand. Peer reviewers add another layer atop this because they are generally hard asses when it comes to articles being published in their bailiwick. They will ask for precise language and methods and clearly stated goals beyond anything you might have anticipated in the process of the writing. I have reviewed papers for several journals, and I find myself sadly being as much of a dickweed as any other reviewer that I have experienced myself. We all act that way in order to maintain standards in science. Now, a third difference from most other publishing is that a very specific and formal writing format must be followed for publishing in science journals, not just standard English. My writing students never seem to quite understand that scientific writing is a completely different animal than just about anything else out there, and that the rules they learned in their college composition courses just barely begin to apply to the process. Journals usually have 4 to 5 pages of small type directions for authors telling them the exact format they desire in everything from font size to the way to present tables and figures. My students generally disbelieve these style sheets even exist, except in my own fevered imagination, until I show them such detailed directions. And oddly enough, worse, it seems that every journal seems to have its own set of style sheets which don't necessarily agree with the way that other journals do. Citations, especially, might be very different in the way they're presented in one journal versus another. Finally, the major difference between most other pieces of writing and those in scientific journals is that the purpose of scientific research papers is not to entertain. Most of my colleagues, except those with a serious screw loose, in my opinion at least, do not curl up with a copy of the European Journal of Molecular Biology to escape and help forget their retirement accounts are quickly becoming more and more worthless each day. No, the purpose of science is to shed light on reality in a carefully designed and accepted fashion. The fact that we do not get paid and do get shredded by peer reviewers is the price that we pay to help expose that truth. If it were easy to get articles published, and we did get paid, then any papers published would be suspect as to the validity of their contents, the soundness of their methods, and the unsullied sincerity of the authors to present the truthful data to support their hypotheses. So where am I going with this blather? What happens when the trust of this system I just described breaks down? This can certainly happen on the part of scientists who make up data whole cloth. Falling into this category is the Korean scientist Hwang Woo-suk, who published articles in Science in 2004 and 2005 and fraudulently reported to have succeeded in creating human embryonic stem cells by cloning. Hwang's name is still cursed in many areas of cell research because he probably set back research by a good decade with his falsehoods. His university fired him, and he was indicted on embezzlement and bioethics law violations, and I suspect that lots of people don't think that's enough. Hwang is the worst example of this fraud in the last 10 years, but my point is there will always be scientists like that. Now, what do you do when you can no longer trust the journal publisher any longer? Scientific publishing giant Elsevier puts out hundreds of journals that cover all the gamuts of science from physics to specialized medical sciences. The disturbing thing that was discovered recently is that between 2000 and 2005, Elsevier published 6 new journals that were actually sponsored by pharmaceutical companies. Now, they looked like peer-reviewed medical journals, but they weren't. Of course, they did not publicly disclose this sponsorship to any researcher. And we can only assume that publication in these bogus journals was, well, a bit easier than in most. Among other journals, the allegations involve the Australasian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine. This publication was paid for by drug company Merck, and basically amounted to a compendium of self-published scientific articles and one-source reviews. Most worrisome is that the journal presented data favorable to Merck's products without any outside review or commentary. The other journal titles involved were the Australasian Journal of General Practice, the Australasian Journal of Neurology, the Australasian Journal of Cardiology, the Australasian Journal of Clinical Pharmacology, and the Australasian Journal of Cardiovascular Medicine. Do you see a pattern here in terms of the titles? Not all of these were paid for by Merck, but apparently some unimaginative drone at Elsevier was asked to title them. Michael Hansen, the CEO of the Medical Publishing Division of Elsevier, says, quote, "We are currently conducting an internal review, but believe this was an isolated practice from a past period in time. It does not reflect the way we operate today. The individuals involved in the project have long since left the company. I have affirmed our business practices as they relate to what defines a journal and the proper use of disclosure language with our employees to ensure this does not happen again. I understand this issue has troubled our communities of authors, editors, customers, and employees." Unquote. You can damn well bet we're troubled. Scientific journals must keep their objectivity or science becomes meaningless. All of scientific progress is a building process, and the future of science depends a great deal on the past. As Sir Isaac Newton said, we stand on the shoulders of giants. No new discoveries or treatments or breakthroughs will be made in the next 10, 20, or 30 years if there's any question as to the integrity of today's publications. If we stand on the shoulders of pygmies, then we'll simply stumble and fall. I think I'm not alone in this worry that these drug companies have corrupted the scientific process based on peer review. I will not go into a tirade about this, but I hope that Elsevier has learned their lesson and that they find out exactly how this happened. It is cold comfort that the perpetrators left the publishing company long ago. Well, sort of related to that first story is my second story of the night. This is not biology. It's kind of a tech report. DVDs and CDs don't last forever. I mean, even if you don't smash them, they're going to degrade over time and your data is simply going to be lost. Magnetic patterns embedded in computer disks degrade steadily over time and they have a life of about 20 years. That means that you shouldn't assume that even sealed, protected DVDs of your wedding in 20 years' time will be usable or seeable. Dr. Alex Zettel of the University of California at Berkeley and his research associates reported this month in the journal Nano Letters on a system that they predict will be much more permanent than DVDs or CDs at the nanoscale level. The researchers describe a technique of placing a single iron crystal, only a few billionths of a meter wide, inside of a hollow carbon nanotube. Nanotubes are among the most stable structures in existence. Once inserted into the tubes, the iron crystals act as data bits and can physically slide from one end of the tube to the other in response to an electric current. The registration of the movement can be interpreted as either a 1 or a 0 in binary code. Zettel says the technology will require further tests, but results from lab experiments suggest the device can retain data indefinitely. Great. I guess that just means that those fake journals from Elsevier will be around for the next billion years or so. Okay, onward and upward. Here's an update on the smallest exoplanet yet found. Remember, exoplanets are those outside of our solar system that are found by magnetic anomalies they produce or by their transit across a star. The star Gliese 581 is now known to host the smallest known exoplanet, being only about 4 times more massive than the Earth. The planet was just discovered by the European Southern Observatory's 3.6-meter telescope at La Silla in Chile. According to astronomers, the planet, Gliese 581e, is almost certainly rocky like Earth, rather than icy or gaseous like the gas giants. Unfortunately, because the planet lies so close to its parent star, which is a red dwarf, it's hot enough to boil away any surface water and could not support life similar to that on Earth. That means that the small planet is not in the so-called life zone of the Gliese 581 solar system. And by the way, a red dwarf, they tend to be cool and red, I guess, but it's still not cool enough for Gliese 581e to retain any water. Another world record was revealed this week in a completely unrelated science at the Biology of Genomes Conference in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. What organism has the most number of unique genes of anyone yet found? And if you said human, you'd be wrong. We are arguably the peak of earthly evolution, but we still only have about 25,000 genes. The winner, surprisingly, is the Daphnia pulex. Commonly known as the water flea, the pinhead-sized crustacean is widespread in lakes and ponds across the world. When first studied, the genome seemed to have about 25,000 genes, like humans. That's a lot, but it's still no record breaker. Eventually, gene-finding computer programs were applied to the sequence, and they found 31,000 genes. Additionally, a variety of experiments have revealed that there may be as many as 8,000 more genes that the gene-finding annotation programs missed. That is a total of about 39,000, which tops the gene count of the newly sequenced genome of another tiny creature, the pea aphid, which sports about 34,600 genes. Now, my last news story concerns caterpillars and their skill at obtaining food and acting as insect-confident men. It's been known for a long time that the caterpillar of the mountain Alcon blue butterfly is very good at mimicking odors produced by ants. Ants communicate, among other ways, by odors. The odor that's produced by the caterpillar is produced so that the ants will ignore it, and it can get right in there with the ants and eat whatever they find. The caterpillars are so good at mimicry, in fact, that the ants will often pick them up and bring them back to the nest as though they were ant larvae. Once in the nest, the caterpillar has hit the jackpot in terms of food, but something odd happens. In the nest, the caterpillar is no longer treated like a larvae anymore. The ant queen acts as though the caterpillar was another rival queen, while the workers behave as though the intruder is a high-ranking ant. The scientists could find no chemical explanation for this phenomenon, so they looked for other ways that the caterpillar might be imitating the queen. Until now, no explanation has been given to be able to explain this weird obeisance to the invading larva. It was thought it might be a chemical signal, but it turns out the caterpillars aren't making anything else other than the I am an ant hormone. In the June 5th edition of the journal Science, Italian and British researchers, led by Dr. Francesca Barbera, found a different explanation for this odd treatment of the caterpillars. Barbera knew that ants could make different sounds based on their social status. For example, noises made by the queen could prompt workers to take up a guard behavior, whereas the noises made by a worker did not, suggesting that the sounds enable the ants to identify the social status of the insect that produced them. The question was whether caterpillars could reproduce those sounds. If they could, then it would mean that the other ants would potentially treat them as royalty. Now, the team used tiny microphones to record the noises made by the caterpillars and their pupa. The caterpillars made similar sounds which the scientists could distinguish from both queen and worker noises, but which were more similar to the sounds made by the queens. So the caterpillars could make the sounds, but would they provoke the workers to behave defensively? The researchers played back the caterpillar noises to the worker ants and the noises made by the pupa, and they had the same effect as the queen noises. The workers switched to their guarding behavior. The caterpillars were actually able to mimic key aspects of the ant communication to successfully raid the ant's nest for food. Now, probably the coolest thing about this finding is that it seems likely that this fascinating story is simply the tip of the iceberg. Many other ant species are parasitized by other butterfly species. Now, the authors of this article suggest that acoustic communication may be widespread in these ants, and that caterpillar fakery may be taking advantage of this. Well, that's all from me for this month. Thanks for listening. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.